The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you. Can you guys all hear me okay? Louder? Okay. So I'll try to speak loud enough. Over the last 10 years or so, we have witnessed a number of new organizations spring up. Now, 10 years may not seem new to all of us, but really in terms of the struggles for social justice and against racism in this country, 10 years is really new. A number of new organizations that have sprung up of self-identified white people who have organizations of white people meant to combat racism. There's a number of these organizations that sort of differ city by city. Some of them are national organizations. Some of them go by different names. We've probably all encountered them on the streets at Black Lives Matter protests. Some of us may be current members of some of the organizations. Some of us may have been involved with some of these organizations in the past. And I want to kind of outline three of them to kind of give people a sense of some of the organizations that I'm talking about. In Chicago here, one of the local organizations that we have is the Chicago League of Abolitionist Whites, CLAW. Now CLAW says that, you know, they describe themselves as CLAW mobilizes white people to abolish white supremacy through education, solidarity fundraising, and turnout to actions. The Chicago League of Abolitionist Whites is a Chicago-based, intergenerational, white-identified organization whose members work to educate and activate other white people. Our goals are transformational in nature, and we work towards abolishing white supremacy, prisons, and policing. Another organization that's a bit more sort of national is calls themselves White People Challenging Racism. Similarly, they describe themselves as bringing people together to examine white privilege and racism in order to galvanize them to anti-racist action. Our mission is to provide people with tools and resources to challenge and change attitudes and actions that perpetuate racism. While our focus is on white people's role in dismantling racism, our courses are open to everyone who is committed to achieving racial justice. And the third organization that I want to outline that folks are probably the most familiar with and exists in cities around the country is Showing Up for Racial Justice, SURGE. They formed shortly after the election of Barack Obama, right around 2009, and they describe themselves as SURGE is a national network of white groups and individuals organizing white people for racial justice. Through community organizing, mobilizing, and education, SURGE moves white people to act as part of a multiracial majority for justice with passion and accountability. We work to connect people across the country while supporting and collaborating with local and national racial justice organizing efforts. SURGE provides a space to build relationships, skills, and political analysis to act for change. Now, SURGE has developed a number of other national and local and regional network affiliations. For instance, I think in 2016, SURGE affiliated with the Democratic Socialists of America. They've also affiliated with local or regional organizations like the Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, which is a more of a liberal NGO type of organization that does a lot of community organizing work throughout the state of Kentucky. Now there's a number of local chapters in cities all across the country of SURGE, and some of them go by different names, and sometimes the politics are uneven. Now there's obviously, you know, one similarity that runs through all three of these organizations, and that is that their sort of objective is to organize white people, or people that identify as white, against racism and for racial justice. Now there's a political unevenness that is in there as well, in terms of some of them approach the question of racism through the liberal lens of writers like Tim Wise that very much view racism as a sort of personal fault that is something that can be overcome on an individual basis through education and workshops, and thus that's the primary way that racism is dismantled. Other activists within these organizations have a much more sort of revolutionary or systemic understanding of racism, that racism is a system that oppresses, obviously people of color and especially black people in this country, but also serves to maintain class divisions and the oppression of even white working class people. Now there's a number of other more radical organizations that have sprung up over the last few years as well. People may have heard of the organization called Redneck Revolt that has an affiliated group called the John Brown Gun Club, where they've done interesting things that they call counter-recruitment, where they have gone to gun shows, NASCAR races, and tabled at these various places in order to talk to poor and working class white people about the issues of racism. Now, I think it's important to understand, while I refer to these organizations as relatively new, that, you know, all these organizations started within the last decade or so, the theoretical underpinnings for these organizations actually go back much further, and indeed to the civil rights movement itself. And so for the middle part of the talk, I actually want to examine a few historical instances of how anti-racists, and in particular white anti-racists, organize themselves. So I'm going to kind of work backwards. So the most recent organizations, then I'm going to touch on the civil rights movement, and then I'm going to work my way backwards to the 1930s and 40s, where there was a different type of approach to fighting racism, and then try to wrap up with what I think is a more effective approach to building an interracial movement to combating racism. Now, obviously, the civil rights movement, as hopefully we are all aware, was an incredibly heroic struggle where people faced some of the most brutal racist repression from the likes of the Ku Klux Klan, police, National Guardsmen, particularly in the South. And we should all be woefully aware of the murders, the lynchings, the harassment, the beatings, the jailings, all of this that went along with that, especially of the black activists that were involved in the civil rights movement. But for white activists as well, who chose to cross the color line and stand with their black brothers and sisters and comrades in the struggle, they also faced brutal repression as well. For instance, one of the very earliest civil rights activists that was murdered in 1963 was a postal worker and an activist in the Congress on Racial Equality Corps named William Moore, who was murdered in 1963, as I said, who was engaging in a sort of one-man march from city to city and town to town to protest segregation and raise awareness among white workers and in the news media around the segregation and violence that was underway. His reason for doing it, as he said, was, quote, "The white man cannot be truly free himself until all men have their rights." Later on, Bob Zellner, who is one of the very early field workers for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee — SNCC members were not organizers or members or activists, they were workers. That's what they called themselves. So Bob Zellner was one of the very early SNCC workers. He was a white man, and like many of us white people from below the Mason and Dixon line, had members of his family that were part of the Ku Klux Klan. He chose very early on in his life as a teenager and later as a college student to become active in SNCC organizing meetings under the cover of the night. He has many stories of sort of sneaking out of the back of churches to avoid the police. But while he was at Huntington College, was actually caught at one of the protests by a number of Klansmen who invaded the march, grabbed him by the legs, and tried to tear him away from the steps while he was brutally beaten while the police watched on. He was nearly lynched by the Klan, but luckily was sort of put into a car after being beaten to a pulp and driven to the next county over and sort of unceremoniously dropped off. Now, Bob Zellner was hired with funding as a SNCC worker by money from the Southern Conference Education Fund, SCEF, which was an organization of a number of radicals in the American South. Carl and Ann Braden are two of the most popularly known. These were two activists that had been part of the trade union movement, were around the Communist Party, and published a newspaper that was called The Southern Patriot, where they tried to speak to white Southerners and white workers in particular in the South about the questions of racism. So the initial money for hiring Bob onto the SNCC staff came from SCEF at the time. And what Ann Braden had in mind when they initiated this project was what she referred to as a white student project. Now, Bob outlined what his approach and what he was hoping to do as a white organizer in SNCC. He said, quote, "I started following up on some of the contacts I already had. There was a great deal of intrigue and curiosity and a real hunger for knowledge about fellow students from the other race on both sides, but especially on the side of young progressive white Southerners. I was not totally aware of the intellectual ferment in the South, but one thing happening at the universities was testing the limits in ways that reminded me of what had happened at Huntington, the college where he had gone and become an activist. Part of it was from reading authors like John Dollard, Gunnar Myrdal, Tom Pettigrew, and C. Van Woodward. Their writings all pointed to the conflict between the American creed and its practice in the South, and helped to convince a whole new generation of white Southerners that they could still be Southern and be against segregation. It showed them that segregation was basically a recent phenomenon in the South and didn't go back to the antebellum period. Part of my thinking during the early period of campus traveling was to work out a modus vivendi and a rationale for the kind of project that we were going to do. And my feeling was that on every campus and in every town, there were some progressive students who wanted to figure out their relationship to the battle forming around them." Now, this is part of the official sort of SNCC policy with Bob Zellner as an organizer, to travel around to campuses throughout the South and rally what he thought was thousands of white students in the American South to the cause of fighting segregation and for racial justice. Now, as often happens, real life and the pace of activity sort of intervened, and much of his campus tour was cut short or only happened in fits and spurts, as he was sort of forced to go to various other cities to help out with the organizing campaigns there. Now, right around 1966, I believe, there's a number of other things happening. Obviously, there is, you know, Malcolm X, who has a few things to say about racism in the United States. And people will remember maybe that famous scene in the Malcolm X movie where there's a young white student woman that comes up to Malcolm X and asks, "What can I do to help you fight racism?" And Malcolm X responds, "Nothing." But later on, he sort of thought about that question. And he gave a different, sort of more in-depth answer. And he wrote, "I tell sincere white people, work in conjunction with us. Each of us working among our own kind. Let sincere white individuals find all other white people they can who feel as they do, and let them form their own all-white groups to work trying to convert other white people who are thinking and acting so racist. Let sincere whites go and teach nonviolence to other white people." Now, right around the same time, there was a number of political fights that was going on within the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. Some of the young radicals that were gravitating towards SNCC and influenced by the politics of Malcolm X And also a bit sort of disheartened by the experience of Freedom Summer and a number of the white students who had come down from northern universities to help out with the voting drives, began to think about what a black organization meant and how to raise black consciousness. And this is the period where the slogans of black power began to enter the movement. And around this time, the Atlanta Project, which was centered at, they call themselves the SNCC Vine City Project, put out a position paper influenced by all of these ideas. Now, up to this point, SNCC had always been an interracial organization with a number of key organizers that were white. Some of their main adult sort of advisors were white. Howard Zinn, for instance, was an early adult advisor. The Vine City Project begins to take a different approach and begins to insert an element of black separatist politics into the organization. In their position paper, they write, "It must be offered that white people who desire change in this country should go where that problem of racism is most manifest. That problem is not in the black community. The white people should go into white communities where the whites have created power for the express purpose of denying blacks human dignity and self-determination. Whites who come into the black community with ideas of change seem to want to absolve the power structure of its responsibility for what it is doing and saying that change can only come through black unity, which is only the worst kind of paternalism. This is not to say that whites have not had an important role in the movement. In the case of Mississippi, their role was very key in that they helped give blacks the right to organize. But that right is now over, that role is now over, and it should be. People now have the right to picket, the right to give out leaflets, the right to vote, the right to demonstrate, the right to print." And so there was a whole section of SNCC which began to call into question the role of white people and the black freedom movement. And I will sort of fast forward, long story short, 1967 rolls around, and through a number of internal struggles and very heated debates, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee becomes an exclusively all-black organization. Which leaves the question, what happens, what do you do with all of these white people who had joined and been jailed and been beaten up and gained all of this experience in organizing and through the black freedom struggle? Where do they go and what do they do? Now, a number of approaches happened. One was a pre-existing organization that was called the Southern Students Organizing Committee, which a number of the former SNCC activists gravitated toward. Another organization that sprung up, which was related to the Southern Conference Educational Fund, SCEF, and the Bradens, was called the Grassroots Organizing Work, GROW. Now, Bob Zellner, who was the prior the white SNCC worker, became one of the main organizers inside of the GROW project. Now, he spoke at this conference, the Socialism Conference, about 10 years ago. And he spoke on some of the history of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the GROW project, and some of his experiences. Now, he had a very interesting thing to say at that conference. He said, "We talked before in one of the workshops here about the black worker struggle." And side note, this is an important thing to say in the discussion that we are having tonight around organizing your own. Our tradition within the ISO has always vigorously defended the right of oppressed groups to organize themselves into black organizations, etc., as an absolute right. I think that what we are calling into question is the utility of a white organization. And so Bob did that at the Socialism Conference. And so he continues. "And it is possible to organize black workers as black workers. But we knew in the GROW project that it was not going to be possible to organize white Southerners as white workers or anything else, because that was going to be a racist formation." Which raises a number of very interesting points. He goes at a length to sort of say white Southerners. Does that raise the question of like, well, what about white students in the North? What about a city like Chicago? Is there a difference there? I'm just gonna put that out there for people to think about. Now, these are the broad contours of the way that things are developing by the end of the Civil Rights Movement and the beginning of the late 1960s and early 1970s. I'm going to take a step back to 1929 and talk about a couple, four different experiences of interracial organization that I think that offer a lot of tremendous lessons for us today. So in 1929, a young seamstress woman who worked at a textile plant in Gastonia, North Carolina, named Ella Mae Wiggins. She was a white woman who lived in a black neighborhood. And I think that in many ways, her life is indicative of the complexities of race and class in this country. That is that white and black are always not easily discernible or separatable as much as American history and the history of segregation would like to have us believe. So Ella Mae Wiggins, a white woman who works at a textile plant, and the textile plants in the American South were notoriously racist and hired almost exclusively white workers. White landless workers that were forced off the land to go into backbreaking, terrible work conditions in the textile mills. So in 1929, the Gastonia strike breaks out. There's a number of very important Communist Party leaders that are there organizing. It's a radical flashpoint and really a precursor to what becomes the great national textile general strike of 1934. All of this stuff is a sort of precursor to the general textile strikes. Now, one of the big problems that the organizers had in Gastonia is in the next neighborhood over, there was another textile plant owned by the same company, but they happened to employ black workers there, and the black workers were not yet out on strike. Now, Ella Mae Wiggins was clear that unless we spread this strike to the other textile plants and we bring the black workers out, her neighbors, the people that watched her children while she was at work on 12-hour days, that their strike was doomed to defeat. Now, she and several of the other textile workers played a very important role in talking to the black workers at the other textile plant, talking about why they were organizing and how incredibly important it was for the black workers to join in the strike and the struggle. She helped to pass a resolution within her local union that desegregated the union and allowed black workers to join, and eventually those black textile workers went out on strike. About a month later, she was out in the street and shot in the chest and killed in broad daylight by racist Klansmen that were in pay of the textile companies. All five of her children were sent to live in orphanages. After less than 30 minutes of deliberation at the trial of her murderers, they were acquitted. This is part of the history of race and the fight against racism in the American South that we don't often hear about. Another one is the Southern Tenant Farmers Union. Now, after Reconstruction and the sort of reinitiation of black codes and the development of the sharecropping system, a whole number of poor blacks were basically forced back into a situation of sharecropping, as well as thousands and thousands of poor whites in the American South. Now, one of the things that these sharecroppers had to figure out was how to organize in the context of the Great Depression, how to organize in the context of the New Deal, how to advance their cause for union recognition, land, money, all of that sort of stuff in an American South that was incredibly divided along the question of race. Now, initially, the Southern Tenant Farmers Union had a segregated union. They had a lot of white tenant farmers and sharecroppers that didn't want to be in a union with black sharecroppers, and black sharecroppers that needed a union and were in their own union. But eventually they found out that in order to be effective, they actually had to organize their union meetings together, they had to organize their protests together, they had to organize their picnics together, their festivals together, their music jam sessions together, all of that stuff in order to become an effective union. Now, this is in an area specifically where some of the high points of lynching violence had occurred. 1943. Again, North Carolina. There's something about North Carolina. Winston-Salem, where they roll the cigarettes and cut the tobacco and dry it, all of that sort of stuff. A dirty job, a hot job, a sweaty job, a job that you don't want to have, a job that was mostly given to black women to work in the tobacco cutting factories. But also a significant number of white workers that were there to operate the machines, to help out with the maintenance work, a whole number of things. Organized one of the most effective organizations, Local 22 of the Farm Tobacco Workers Union. Now, this was a union that was integrated from the beginning, and a union that had black women that were elected to its leadership by other black women, as well as white men and women that were workers on the shop floor. Now, one black worker described the situation at the time. She said, "The company preached to the white worker. They would take them in the office, they would hold group meetings with them in their homes. The white preacher was advising the people, you better stay out of that union, they're going to turn that thing into open violence. You're going to have to eat and sleep with them black men, your wife and daughter." Or as a Greensboro, North Carolina paper put it at the time, "It was the system, and it always worked in tobacco, textiles, and everywhere, divide and conquer. Keep the black workers resenting the whites for that 10 cents more an hour they made. Keep the white workers resenting the black workers for working so cheaply and making them fear for their jobs. Keep them separate. That way they never get to join forces in a real union, black and white." The late 1940s and early 1950s in Louisville, Kentucky. International Harvester. We should all be familiar with the history and legacy of the International Harvester, the great company that brought us the massacres that turned into the protests, that brought us the May Day rallies, the Haymarket Martyrs, a whole number of things, had a plant in Louisville, Kentucky. Now there, they had a plan from the very get-go, where they were trying to keep not just the workforce, but the entire city segregated. International Harvester owned the city at the time. Has anybody ever had a hot brown, the dinner? Yeah, there's a few Kentuckians in here. So the hot brown, it's a plate of like roast beef and gravy. It's not particularly good. But it was invented at this hotel called the Brown Hotel, where black folks were not allowed to go. International Harvester owned and ran, and you know, they probably played golf with the people that ran the Brown Hotel. But the Farm Workers Union had to figure out how to overcome all of that in order to build an effective union there. They said solidarity was demonstrated in their community. The union organized an interracial picnic in segregated Cherokee Park. Police intervened and suggested that the picnic take place in the predominantly black Chickasaw Park. The union later obliged, and 200 white union members attended the activity in Chickasaw Park. That did not deter the membership from once more having its picnic at Cherokee Park. Similar union activities were held at the segregated Brown Hotel, which continued to remain segregated until the late 1950s. What aided solidarity were bonds that exceeded racial differences. Among the rank and file, most of the members were young. Three-fourths were World War II veterans, where they learned the value of freedom and equality and dignity. And also, a side note, that experience of being in war and combat and the general labor of black and white folks together. They would not tolerate disrespect, and they were reared in rural communities. Company offensive actions were met with, "That just ain't fair." A women's auxiliary was formed in the June of 1949, followed by a successful integrated union dance. Women brought their children to join in the picket line in 1952. For many years, the union seemed invincible, the strongest in the nation. Now, all of these labor sort of organizing conflicts and stuff that I'm outlining from the 1930s up through the 1950s, in many respects, are the basis and the preface for what becomes the civil rights movement in so many of these communities. In fact, without the farm workers organizing in the 1940s in Louisville, you would not have had the Black Workers for Justice in the 1960s in Louisville. The farm tobacco workers in North Carolina became one of the main organizations that pressed for the civil rights movement and actions in North Carolina at the time. The Southern Tenant Farmers Union has given us a whole host of culture, of songs, of protests, etc., that continues to inform ourselves. Now, it seems for many folks, I mean, obviously these are the stories in our history that we aren't taught about in school on a day-to-day basis. So for many folks entering the struggle for racial justice today, there seems to be a common sense of, well, there are the black organizations. The black organizations historically, even Malcolm X has told white people that white people should go and organize white people, to organize your own, as they say. But it does raise a whole number of questions, and I want to kind of go through some of those questions in order to spark some discussion and hopefully some debate here after I wrap up. One is the question of dismantling racism. All of the new white organizations use this phrase. What does it mean to dismantle racism? Can we just simply dismantle racism amongst white folks? What is the role of racism amongst non-white people? How do we dismantle that? Is the racism merely implicit in ourselves as individuals, or how do we dismantle the racism that's systemic and inherent in capitalism? Many of these politics accept the question of white privilege. That is, that white folks gain some sort of psychological or even material privilege from the fact of racism, and are there to help perpetuate racism. Now, if we contrast this to the statement that the tobacco worker from North Carolina had said, where they try to keep the white folks resentful of the blacks because they work cheaper, and the black folks resentful of the white folks because they get 10 cents more an hour. Does that amount to privilege, and how do we understand that? Is there a role of these organizations in policing the boundaries of race? And what I mean by that is, what does it mean to be a white identified individual? How does someone gain access to whiteness? Is it just their own self-avowed whiteness that allows them to be part of these organizations? And how do the organizations and events that are organized by these groups police these boundaries of race? Now, I want to give one example by a writer named Hari Ziad, who wrote a piece last year about the Black Pride event that was going on. Now, he was making the argument that queer black folks should not bring their non-black partners to black pride events, especially white people. He says in the article, anti-blackness is inherent to whiteness, and thus anti-blackness moves in all space where white people are. The state does not ask for intentions when it designates black people a threat. Every white person has the state and its guns at their behest and a gentrifying tongue in their mouth, whether they intend it or not. This is not about the likelihood of your friend shouting an epithet. It is about the likelihood that their comfort means the disregard of ours. And so it does seem, compounded by another event that happened in September of last year in St. Louis, where there was a protest in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement that was called a white allies only protest. Now, it does seem to beg some questions to me around what type of movement and what are the goals of the movement that we are trying to organize? Are we trying to organize a movement that dismantles racism in a real way that allows people, black, white, brown, all colors to interact with each other on the basis of a common and shared humanity, and on that basis build a common and shared struggle together to recognize that humanity? Or are we trying to build a movement that is perpetually trying to police the boundaries of its own identities? Now, Bob Zellner, to return to him, when he was in the GROW project, and he talked about this when he was at the Socialism Conference several years ago, was discussing a wildcat strike that broke out in Laurel, Mississippi in 1968. 25% of the workers on this wildcat strike were black. The rest of the workers on that strike were white, many of whom were known members of the Ku Klux Klan. Now, he had brought a young GROW activist with him and said, look, there's going to be some Klan members on this picket line, so don't be surprised to hear some racist shit. Now, when they got to the picket line, he met with one of the white workers, and Bob sort of recounts asking him, like, well, what do you think about the Negro? And the guy says, well, I would never eat with one, and I would never let one date my daughter. That's his response. And the young GROW activist turns to Bob and says, wow, what are you doing relating to these racists on strike? Like, what is this all about? And Bob motions for the striker, to the white striker, to come back over him and talk to him. And he says, well, hey, where did you eat dinner at last night? And he says, well, I ate at the Union Hall. And he says, oh, yeah, who was sitting next to you? And he's like, well, this black guy that works with me. Now, one of the things that Bob Zellner was really astute at pointing out for working class white people especially is how, given the shared material conditions and the interest in organizing at a workplace, at a community, or wherever, that often people's actions in their real day-to-day life can run ahead of where they think that the ideology or the ideas in their head are. In other words, this guy certainly would not describe himself as a anti-racist, or even a non-racist, would probably describe himself as obviously a racist. But here he is organizing with black workers and sharing meals together, and it didn't immediately dawn on him. And this is where I want to wrap up, is that this is ultimately the problem of exclusively white organizing spaces, is that if white workers and poor white people are only in those spaces of engaging in activism and fighting back and organizing and learning with other white people, they're never actually put in the situation where they have to contend with the real life of what it means to be struggling with black people and black leadership, in the sense that the white workers at the tobacco plant or the sharecroppers were, or the white workers at International Harvester in Louisville, Kentucky were. These are the basis on which racist ideas can be broken down in a very concrete way, in a very material way, on a basis of shared mutual interests and goals. The organizations that have sprung up recently, Surge, Claw, etc., get it backwards and demand that the white people that come to the organizing already have these ideas, that they're already non-racist or anti-racist, when really what our goal is to convince the entire working class, black and white, that racism is a central fight to organize against. Whether we call it that or not, that's the key thing. And I'll just wrap up there.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.